It's the day we've all been waiting for. It's the 19th of April, 2024. Happy Friday. Delicious, glorious. You can smell it. You can taste it. Friday, I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Derek Hunter Podcast. Don't forget, midnight tonight, patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast or DerekHunter.locals.com, whichever you prefer, is when the Week in Effin' Review drops. And my God, the week needs to be effin' reviewed. Does it not? Yes, it does. Check it out. Please support the program. All that good stuff. That's all I ask is $5 a month to keep the program going. We don't have tote bags like NPR. We have U-Hauls full of information. That's all you need. So thank you for that. Let's get started so we can get done. As always, there is a ton of stuff going on in the world, and we'll be here to unbox it and unpack it for you. And I have to start off with our president. I see more energy in The Walking Dead than I do in Joseph Robinette Biden, honestly. When you watch this guy, he was up in Pennsylvania. He was in Pittsburgh. He goes to the, where was it? He went to the headquarters of the United Steelworkers is what it was. See, Nippon Steel, there's a choice. You can either have a job or not have a job. And it's weird to see Democrats rally around not having a job. Nippon Steel is looking, they're out of Japan, as the name might suggest. They're looking into buying U.S. Steel. Now, why? Well, because U.S. Steel is going out of business, right? It's kind of an important detail that is usually left. It's not a hostile takeover. It is, we're going under. And other people are going, well, we can probably keep you afloat, or we think that there are, in fact, there's money to be made from keeping you in business, which is the only reason businesses exist. If they're not making money, there's no reason to exist. No business starts off going, you know what we really want to do? We want to make sure that we employ people. That's just not how business works. So when you go through a downturn, as the steel industry has been. You also have China dumping steel at below market prices to damage U.S. steel markets, and it has worked, and this administration hasn't done all that. Now suddenly they're interested, but up until now, less so. Now that Pennsylvania is in play, suddenly Joe Biden is a protectionist and talking about tariffs, but that's for another story. The idea that somebody would come in and say, we're going to pay almost $15 billion for your company and keep it afloat, you'd think would be good news. But it's not. Everybody in the political world is like, well, Nippon Steel, Japan, foreign ownership, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, realistically, the other alternative for Nippon is a company, another U.S. company. It's Cleveland something. It doesn't matter what it's called. They offered less than half of what Nippon was offering for U.S. Steel. Because they're not doing super great either. They don't have piles of cash sitting around. The steelworkers union said, no, not interested in Nippon, foreign ownership. Democrats, oh, foreign ownership. Trump even, foreign ownership. Can't do. I don't understand what these people think is going to happen. The physical plants for U.S. Steel are in the United States, as suggested by the name. And unless you employ Superman to come over and physically remove it from the earth and fly it overseas, they will remain in the United States of America throughout the existence of the company. That means, should, God forbid, Japan become an enemy again, and I understand history, so it's not out of the realm of possibility, but should Japan become an enemy again, they can't go, well, we're going to refuse to. It's not Japanese government, by the way, that's looking at it. It's a Japanese company. But they can't say, well, we're going to refuse to provide you with steel you need for your military defense and your war against Japan. You know why they can't do that? I mean, I suppose they could. But with the powers granted the president from the Defense Production Act, he can simply seize the factory. Then it becomes owned by the U.S. government, controlled by the U.S. government, and they can continue operating as normal to produce whatever it is, weapons or machinery. In the meantime, the company will have kept the factory open and working. And I don't know if you understand how major factories work, but if you shut them down for an extended period of time, they make it very difficult to restart them. You need to come in and retool everything. You need the tool and die guys to go through. It's a very difficult thing. So keeping the factory going is kind of a good thing. And keeping it going with some job security, a better thing, I would think. But because we are at a time of economic uncertainty and Bidenomics is really causing everything to get more expensive, people are wildly skeptical of everything. It reminds me of in the 80s when growing up in Detroit, the auto industry was in the toilet. And rather than look at the big three and the leadership of the big three and the horrible, god-awful decisions they made, and they made horrible, god-awful decisions like, oh, gas prices are going up, but people want bigger cars. Let's not give them any alternative, and let's make sure that we got at least a half a football field between the front and rear wheels there on this thing. And some of those cars really, truly were. When Japan started dominating the market because they had smaller, fuel-efficient cars that were more affordable, rather than put pressure on Detroit to adapt, Detroit rolled out Japanese cars into parking lots and charged $5 to swing a sledgehammer five times on it. Because the reason there were layoffs, the reason there were not profit-sharing checks, the reason there was whatever, was somebody else's fault. It's very easy to blame somebody else for your problems. And I say that with the understanding that the somebody else can literally be anybody else and the problems can literally be anything. It's much easier just to have somebody say, well, what your problem is this person bringing toxic this into your life. Toxic. Oh, all right, well, I'll just do that. It's problem solved rather than actually deal with the underlying issues of the problem. You might have kicked the can down the road. You have a couple of good weeks, months, or years. Then, believe it or not, your bags find you. Your baggage finds you. It's better to deal with the baggage rather than just leave it in a locker at the airport. But they blamed, Detroit blamed Japan effectively. People bought into it. And I remember seeing people sling a sledgehammer. You'd be surprised, at least back now, a car would snap in half. They're crumple zones and everything. But back then, they'd always older cars. It was never like brand new cars coming out. People, big dudes, swing a 5-pound sledgehammer, and you'd go, okay, there's a mark on the car, but it was tough to mess those cars up. You could see why, like, if somebody hit a telephone pole and the telephone pole was down the block. Now you hit a telephone pole and the car is no thicker than the telephone pole anymore when it's over with. But it is easy to just go, oh, it's their fault, it's the other people's fault. Honestly, I don't really care who owns the company. I want the jobs to stay. I would think the company willing to pay more for it would be more solvent, liquid, financially better positioned to keep the jobs here in the United States. Not that those jobs can be exported, they'd just be shut down, right? They'd just be closed. So keep the factory open with the company that can keep the factory open for as long as possible. The steel industry ebbs and flows like every industry, and if you can get past the next corner, it could be good for a while. But instead, there's political mileage to be made out of complaining about it. The president is moving to oppose the issue. It has to be, since it is a vital industry and the government has to sign off on it, the president can block it, so to speak. He hasn't fully blocked it yet. He's come out against it, but hasn't used the full weight of it. It's a long bit of foreplay. Trump's doing the same thing. I oppose this, whatever, but they're not actively doing much about it. It's a lot like the border has been over the past 20 years. We need to do something about the border. We need to do something about the border. Nobody wants to actually do something about the border. If you actually solve a problem, how do you run on that problem? If you dangle, especially in Pennsylvania, if you're Joe Biden, if you dangle the prospect of people in the steel industry in the Pittsburgh area losing their jobs in front of them, but you say you have the solution, you will make sure that whatever it is, they don't lose their jobs, but you don't do anything about it because it's, you know, you take your time, you don't come out and take a firm opinion that could really be a difference maker one way or another, you get to hang that sword of Damocles over their heads throughout the entirety of the election. If you come out and say, here, I've made X decision, whatever it is, your jobs are safe, don't worry, all you're stressed, forget it. Well, then people are no longer, people vote for their immediate needs. If you're hungry, you'll vote for food. If you're worried about losing your job, you'll vote for whoever can promise you that your job will be safe. If you remove, you give the hungry person a sandwich, then they can go, you know what, I really don't like the open border. If you give the job insecure person job security, then they're free to go, you know what, I don't like the fact that it cost me $100 to go to the grocery store for 3 days worth of food anymore. I don't like the fact that gas prices are ridiculously high. You remove their top concern, then it gives them time to go deal with their other concerns. That's why Joe Biden isn't really going to do all that much. Pittsburgh area is a blue-collar area that went for Trump. The Philadelphia area is the drug-addled area that went for Joe Biden. So he needs to pull a lot of support if he's going to carry Pennsylvania again from the people who didn't largely vote for him, didn't vote for him as much as they would like. And the best way to do that is to dangle the prospect of jobs and losing their jobs over them. That's a hell of a motivator. But he was out there at the steelworkers event, and it's telling about Joe Biden's campaign events. He goes to safe spaces. I'm surprised he's not like going to Play-Doh and puppy dog rooms on college campuses. His entire campaign is safe spaces. It is union halls. Well, what happens at a union hall? The union halls get to self-select who gets to be on the stage with the president, gets to be in the room with the president. Union halls are never big enough to hold everybody, especially when you're bringing in the national press, a whole bunch of White House staff, et cetera, et cetera. You got a room that will hold 200 suddenly becomes a room that will hold 100 because the president's entourage, whether they're part of his campaign or not, they roll in with things. Cameras take up a bunch of rooms. Well, if you've got a 200-member union, local, or 300 or 500 or whatever it is, and you go, well, we can only get 100 in there. Guess who gets it? It's not, you, hey, Joe, you hate Joe Biden. You want to go heckle him? The union bosses are on board. They're not about to do that. It is people who are on the team. It is people who don't need to be given new Biden-Harris T-shirts because they've still got the old one. And they can slap it on. So you go to those events and those events only, and you go, this is pathetic. They're quiet. Even the people who are on board are quiet with Joe Biden, for Joe Biden. So he's in front of these people, and he starts to give, well, he's giving a talk. His batteries were low. He was out. I don't know. The Adderall had worn off. Hunter took all the blow that day. I don't know what the deal was. But he was absolutely, nobody had given him caffeine, might conflict with God knows whatever medicine they're giving him. And he starts to recount a story of his uncle, whom he later called his grandfather. Again, you know, it's the Biden family. Wouldn't surprise me. given that Hunter left his wife for Beau's widow, you know, anything is possible in the Biden family. But aside from the lack of energy in this speech, note the lie that he tells based on an Atlantic article written by the editor-in-chief of the Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, probably 2009, when Donald Trump was alleged to have told the Secret Service that he wasn't going to Normandy to mark the anniversary of D-Day because it was raining. He didn't want to mess up his hair. And besides, it was a bunch of suckers and losers being there who died. None of this was true. Literally every human being in the room, including those who now hate Donald Trump, said this didn't happen. This is not true. The Secret Service said the Normandy was 2 hours away by driving. They would have taken Marine One, but the weather was too bad to fly Marine One safely. That way they don't take a lot of chances with the president's life. And so the Secret Service blocked him. But it didn't matter. The lie was in print. The lie stuck. And Joe Biden repeats the lie because, I mean, he's a liar. But here he is recounting that story, and he tells something about his uncle slash grandpa. This is long before DNA, so whatever. And cannibalism in this as well.
Back in when D-Day occurred, and on Sunday, the next day, my mother's four brothers all went down to the recruiting station and joined the military. Every one of them volunteered. And my uncle, they called him Ambrose Brosey, they called him Bosey. My uncle Bosey was a hell of an athlete, they tell me, when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there used to be there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea. And then my son volunteered to go to Iraq for a year, and he came back with stage 4 glioblastoma. And they gave, like many of you, risked your lives, and you know people who gave their lives to the country. They're heroes. But one of the things that I, as I was doing that today, I was reminded of what my opponent said in Paris not too long ago. They asked him to go visit American grave sites. He said no, he wouldn't do it because they were all suckers and losers. I'm not making that up. Staff was listening to acknowledge it today. Suckers and losers. That man doesn't deserve. To have been the commander in chief for my son.
No man doesn't deserve to be the commander in chief for my son. His son came back from Iraq with brain cancer because he claims burn pits, but Bo was in Iraq in 2009 for 9 months. He was diagnosed with brain cancer four or five years later. So, again, that doesn't line up. Also, the idea that after D-Day, the whole family went down there and enlisted in the military. After D-Day? After June 6th, 1944? So Pearl Harbor didn't impact them? Nothing else? The war in North Africa? No, nothing. Not interested. Oh, now D-Day. Now that it looks like the tide is turning, they're going to run down there? I think he's mistaken there because most people went down and enlisted after Pearl Harbor, not after D-Day. There was a draft. Like by the time of D-Day, there was a full-blown draft. You would have been called up already. He doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. He's half asleep there. But then he goes, my uncle, grandpa, they didn't find his body because cannibals or something. Now, this didn't make any sense, this story. Also, the whole idea that Donald Trump called everybody losers, et cetera, which is demonstrably false. And Joe Biden then adds in his own. He's repeating the lie from The Atlantic. Then he repeats the. Then he just creates a lie. Everybody's staff was with him at the time. Verified that they didn't. They've actually said the opposite. It's all on the record. But why let the facts stand in the way of a good story when you're still out there spewing the fine people on both sides lie? Why are you going to let a little bit of truth seep in anywhere? You just don't have it in you, Joe. Okay, let's get to Joseph Robinette Biden. Now, this is later on in the day. He's got more energy. I don't know. Maybe somebody gave him a little toot, a little bump in the car. And he's at the tarmac near the near Air Force One. Now, it's a little hard to hear. There is a lot of ambient noise. This is the problem with a president who only speaks in union halls where he's asleep, or on the tarmac where he's drowned out, or near Marine One where you can't hear him because they won't let him near a reporter or reporters anywhere near him any other time. But he sort of reiterates what he'd said in the lie in the union hall.
Ambrose Finnegan, when they called him Uncle Posey, he was shot down. He was an Army Air Corps before there was an Air Force. He flew single-engine planes, reconnaissance flights.
over New Guinea. He had volunteered because someone couldn't make it. He got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals in New Guinea at the time. They never recovered his body, but the government went back when I went down there and they checked and found some parts of the plane and the like. And what I was thinking about when I was standing there was when Trump refused to go up to the memorial for veterans in Paris, and he said they're a bunch of suckers and losers.
I love how nobody bothered to look for this guy until Joe Biden was vice president and sometime in the 2010s, presumably, and they found pieces of the plane. New Guinea is not, you know, a deserted island. Did nobody notice pieces of a plane there forever? Okay, but then the AP, they decided to look at this a little bit. Zeke Miller, this is the most soft-pedaled thing you could possibly imagine insofar as a fact check goes. The way to put it in this headline, and you know most people don't read beyond the headline. Biden is off on details of his uncle's World War II death as he calls Trump unfit to lead the military. Like, what? Yeah, there's no cannibals. No cannibalism. They don't know why his plane went down, but he was not eaten up by cannibals. That's the fact check. That's just a small detail that was the whole point of it. The military has no record of that at all. And then there's, at the beginning of the first clip where he's getting choked up at the end, the man is not fit to be commander-in-chief of my son. Bo Biden died in 2015. Donald Trump was sworn into office January 20th, 2017. He was never commander-in-chief while Bo Biden was alive. But all that soft-pedaled, all that is a fact. And he lied. He was wrong about everything. But, meh. It's just he got some of the details wrong. Which details? Well, all of them. When all of them. The Democrat, Zeke Miller writes, the Democratic president also misstated when his uncles enlisted in the military, saying they joined, quote, when D-Day occurred the next day in June 1944, when they actually joined weeks after December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. Yeah, like I just said. After Finnegan's death, a local newspaper published a telegram from General Douglas MacArthur expressing condolences to Finnegan's family. And then there's the contents, the wording of the telegram, which it's these, no offense to anybody out there, these were the equivalent of form letters, right? That's all they were. Biden, in his 2008 book, promises to keep made only brief mention of his uncle, describing him as a flyer who was killed in New Guinea. But now he's got all these wonderful details. He was shot down by cannibal. They threw a spear at him, and then they skewered him. They made some nice chops out of him. He had a good thigh meat on him, and they just made delicious chops. The guy's life is a lie. This is a sign of wild insecurity, by the way. This is a sign of massive wild insecurity, which you would think being president of the United States would get you over. What do I mean a sign of wild insecurity? You lie about yourself. Every one of Joe Biden's lies are designed to make him seem cool, seem better. Everybody knows somebody who, no matter what, you tell a story, you guys, oh man, we barely escaped a bear attack, whatever. We're in the woods. We ran around and got into the car just in time as the bear came up. And, oh, man, scared the hell out of us. What an amazing thing. And most people will go, my God, bear attack. That's a hell of a story. And let it end there. Then there are the wildly insecure who cannot handle the fact that people aren't paying attention. It's insecurity and arrogance coupled together, the two worst things to combine. It's like peanut butter and sauerkraut. It's not peanut butter and chocolate at all. Those are the people who go, well, I was chased by two bears one time. These are the girlfriend in Canada people. If you grew up anywhere near the border, I don't know what it was in Maryland or where you live, but there was the people who were just wildly insecure. I don't know, when you started to notice that girls existed. And somebody got a girlfriend or somebody got something. And at that time, having a girlfriend meant I don't know what it meant. It was like you talk to him at recess. Oh, man, get a girlfriend. And he goes, you don't have a girlfriend. Like, I have a girlfriend. You don't know her. She lives in Canada. It was easy to put everybody in Canada because you couldn't disprove it. Joe Biden's life seems to be the continuation of the girlfriend in Canada. The idea that, well, it's, you know, I've got glory. I've got a whole bunch of things. Joe Biden doesn't have accomplishments of his own, not ones that one can be proud of. So he tries to get them by proxy. He's led an interesting life, but other people have led lives of more consequence. And so he fills in details, adds them up, adds to them that had no basis in reality, all designed to make him look good. Corn Pop was a bad dude. He was going to kill me because I called him Sonia Henney. It was terrible. And I had a tire chain and went out there and, okay, I have no... Corn Pop is real. I've read his obituary. Whether or not he got into a fight with Joe Biden, I don't know. It seems a little weird, but it's entirely possible. But if somebody's going to... If a gangster's going to kick your ass because you called him Sonia Henney, and then you say, I shouldn't have called you that, they don't then go, oh, well, all right, as long as you're apologizing, we'll let it go. Right? I don't think Sammy the Bull Gravano snapped and was going to murder a waiter or something. And they said, hey, sorry, I got your steak rare when you wanted medium. Like, oh, all right. Well, now I won't kill you. I don't know. Maybe that's how it works. I guess I've been rolling in the right crowds my whole life. But if you look at Joe Biden's whole life and his own life story, it is a nonstop blowing smoke up his own rear end, which I guess makes sense since his head is up there already. It's convenient. But he talks about going, you know, most people did not go and visit Nelson Mandela while he was imprisoned on Robben Island, right? Most people didn't. Joe Biden did, but it can't just be that he went down there and did it. You know, remember, pretty much all members of the Senate and Congress did back then. But it can't just be that he did it. He had to add that he was arrested while trying to do it. He was arrested because he was down there with black congressional leaders and they didn't like it. They had apartheid and he was not about to be separated. He was not going to be treated differently than the black members of Congress. He was a man of principle who, when afforded the opportunity in real time, did not involve himself in the civil rights movement at all. Even though that didn't stop him from claiming he had later on in life. And he goes, oh my God, he was arrested in South Africa, even temporarily, for an hour. That would make news, even in the 1980s. And there was zero record of it. And so then they talked. See, the problem is Joe Biden told a story about that involved people who are still alive, right? The congressional delegation that went with him, I forget which member it was, but the guy's still alive. And so they went to him and said, hey, was Joe Biden arrested? It's weird. They're never critical like that. So tell us about the time Joe Biden was arrested for standing in solidarity with you guys while you were forced to use the black entrance. And he said, no, we'll all go through the same door. And he's like, what are you talking about? That didn't. Joe Biden never got arrested in South Africa. In Joe's story, I don't even know where this story happened. Nobody's bothered to fact check it that much. He claimed to have landed in Soweto, going to visit Nelson Mandela and Robben's Island when it's called Robben Island. But Robben Island is about 1,000 miles away from Soweto, whereas Cape Town is right there. He could have flown right into it. Why they would have flown to Soweto is something nobody bothered to ask. We don't know if he did. But ultimately, the, quote, arrest was that Joe Biden was told this is the white people entrance to the country. And Joe Biden, being the man of principle that he was, walked over to that door and went into the country. That became Joe Biden being arrested and doing hard time right in the same cell as Nelson Mandela. And you go, this guy, why would you add that detail? The fact that you went there is enough, right? It's enough. But his whole life has been embellishment. The famous clip of him from 1987. I bet I have a much higher IQ than you do. I went to law school on a full academic scholarship. The only person in my class to go on a full academic scholarship. He didn't. He had a half scholarship that was based on need, not on academics. I mean, can anybody imagine a world where Joe Biden got an academic scholarship for whatever? He said I didn't care too much about the law school, so I was in the bottom half of the class. And then I cared again and finished in the top two-thirds of my class. And if you think about the half and two-thirds, you go, okay, well, there's a Venn diagram. There's a lot of overlap there, a lot of overlap between half and two-thirds, right? So he could have not moved at all and still the same unit of measure. But then it turns out that he was 76 in a class of 84, which would put him well outside either one of those units of measure because he was lying. Joe Biden could have just said he went to law school because he did go to law school, that he got his Juris Doctorate because he did get it. Nobody would have questioned it. I doubt he would have ever been asked, hey, where did you finish in the class? But his braggadocio, his chest pumping, his jutting out of his chin and his insistence that he is somehow special caused people to go, all right, we're going to look into these things. He claimed to have gotten academic awards that didn't exist and other ones that he didn't get. He claimed all sorts of accomplishments that did not happen. He now claims that he was involved in the civil rights movement, even though 40 years ago, he's on tape in the 80s going, I didn't get involved in the civil rights movement as a young man. I just didn't. Now he claims he was raised in the black church, in the Puerto Rican community, in the synagogue, and I don't know, whatever else you got. Soon he's going to be, if it suits his needs in order to win the votes in Dearborn, he's going to be, when I was a teenager, I really thought seriously about becoming an imam because I was raised in the mosque. I can't wait for him to roll up his sleeve and tattoo. I have the tattoo of the words, the Prophet Muhammad rules, on my bicep. It's just an unbelievable existence, and he can Mr. Magoo his way through the truth, just lie all the destruction in his wake, one on top of the other, and I've just barely literally scratched the surface on his lies. I was going to use the word embellishments, but that's wrong. His lies about himself. Most of his lies are about himself and his son. My son died in Iraq. No, he didn't. My son died in Iraq. No, he didn't. Oh, I know your children got killed in Afghanistan due to my incompetence, but I know exactly what you're going through because my son died in Iraq. No, your son died in Bethesda of brain cancer. Unless you gave it to him out of your idiocy, your incompetence led directly to their children's death. You having also suffered loss is not really relevant. It's a guy who dined out on the death of his wife and his daughter in 1972. And then it wasn't enough to just say that they died in a car accident. For 10 years, he said that the other guy was drunk. Until the family of the other guy said, we're going to sue you if you don't stop. Then he finally stopped. Losing your wife and your infant daughter is tragedy. You're getting all the sympathy you can possibly elicit from human beings under those circumstances. Why do you feel the need to lie? Because you're wildly insecure. And you're incredibly arrogant. You can't just exist. You can't just be, a normal person like everybody else. You have to be in the room as the decisions matter, as the decisions that matter make. That's why Joe Biden speaks with authority about his foreign policy prowess as the world is falling apart around us. As former Defense Secretary Robert Gates said under Barack Obama, Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of every foreign policy issue for 40 years. That's why Barack Obama said, never underestimate Joe Biden's ability to F things up. These are the people who know him best. And it seems that the people who know him best like him the least. No wonder he lies all the time. Shift gears and talk. We'll talk more about immigration. Immigration's always in the news. There, They're dealing with it up in New York. They're dealing with it in other places. They're dealing with it in weird ways. Americans are being kicked out of public housing accommodations. Veterans are being kicked out of public housing accommodations to accommodate illegal aliens. New York is giving out debit cards full of cash, putting people up in hotels. It's costing a fortune. Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles, is now making an appeal to wealthy Los Angelinos, I guess Angelinos, I guess is what they're called, to please donate money to buy housing for illegal aliens so that they can, you can save the city money or something. It's bizarre that you would ask people to pay, people who are, you know, paying taxed to death. You'd ask them to please volunteer property, asking them to please build buildings, or if they own, if rich people own buildings, give them buildings up in Seattle. They're asking people in Oregon, Portland, I believe, is they're incentivizing people to basically adopt an illegal alien. Please put them in your house. It's bizarre because we've always had homeless people in this country. We've always had homeless people in this country. And the left really only seems to notice them when there's a Republican in the office. The Reagan administration, suddenly homelessness was created. During the Clinton administration, homelessness wasn't really mentioned at all. They returned under George W. Bush. But this push to house the illegal aliens is bizarre because it's coming at the expense of Americans. Here's the Los Angeles Times story. Mayor Karen Bass urges LA's wealthy to fund homeless housing as she forges ahead with her fight against homelessness. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has gone looking for help in all sorts of places. She's teamed up with Los Angeles County agencies to bring mental health services to the city's sprawling homeless encampments. She has lobbied Sacramento for more money to build temporary housing, and she has persuaded officials in Washington to loosen rules to determine when a homeless Angelino becomes eligible for a federally funded apartment. You getting a federally funded apartment? Now the mayor is asking LA's wealthiest Angelinos for help. Now, this one I actually like. On Monday, on her State of the City address, she unveiled a new campaign that asks business leaders, philanthropic organizations, and others to donate millions of dollars to an effort to acquire buildings so they can be used as apartments for the city's homeless population. Quote, "We have brought the public sector together, and now we must prevail on the humanity and generosity of the private sector." Now, this is great. This is a put your money where your mouth is, people. The wealthy in Los Angeles not only fund the Democratic Party in California, they largely fund the Democratic Party nationwide. There's a reason Joe Biden goes to California so often, and it's not because he wants to see the beach. He's got a mansion on the beach. He's got that covered. It's not because he wants the warmth. It's pretty, we can go to Florida, he can go wherever he wants, and it gets really hot and sticky in Washington, D.C. It's because every time he leaves Los Angeles, he leaves with a plane load of money. They fund the Democratic Party nationwide. This is an ultimate put your money where your mouth is moment. Now, you might think that the idea of asking people to take their money and buy a building, retrofit it to house illegal aliens, that might seem a little bit odd, a bridge too far, but these are the open borders crowd. These are the people who want unfettered illegal immigration. Asking them to pay is great. It'd be nice, and it would never happen. But if I were a cynical person that I am, and I had the power to do it, I would then set up these homeless encampments and these buildings or whatever in the neighborhoods of these wealthy Angelinos, or at the near the gates of their gated community, perhaps across the street from the guard towers that keep them safe, near the shops where they shop, or somewhere along the route between Rodeo Drive and wherever they happen to live. I would make them have a big dose of their own medicine. They are the ones who encourage this. It's not enough. If they have, if you have hundreds of millions of dollars, it's not all that much to really genuinely just break off $1 million and throw it toward the problem. They do it towards politicians all the time. It's weird because these are the people who set up, they view paying taxes as charity. So they don't really give all that much in taxes. They also set up charitable funds in their own. They're always named after themselves. The superstar, twice-nominated Academy Award actor foundation is giving money to. All it really is a tax dodge. They funnel their money through that so they can lessen their tax burden. It's weird. The people who advocate for people who demand higher taxes, then, you know, everything they do is part of the charitable trust. That means that the charity pays for it. They pay like 3% of their income to the charitable cause and live off of the rest. You talk to your accountant to figure out how to do that, but you probably can't afford to. But if they started having to deal with a big dose of their own medicine, I would absolutely love it. If they had to deal with the reality of their circumstances, it's very, very easy to be philanthropic with other people's money. It is very easy to advocate for a cause that will never get in the same zip code as you as far as dealing with it. The people who are the loudest advocates for unfettered illegal immigration are the people who live in places where the only time an illegal immigrant gets within the same area code as them, back when they used to have area codes that matter, is if they're doing yard work at a cut rate expense, where if they cut their fingers off, what are you going to do? Sue me? You're in the country illegally, et cetera, et cetera. But you can get your lawn cut for cheap. It'd be nice to bring it home for them. It would be nice to bring it home for them. New York City is different than California. The problem in New York City is being brought home for so many of these leftists. Because you can just, you can set up a camp, you can set up a tent, you can just collapse on the sidewalk and take a dump, is what they're doing, outside of anywhere, on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, wherever it is. They're having it brought home. They're being mugged. Even the rich people in Los Angeles, nobody walks in L.A. Nobody walks anywhere in L.A. The rich people in New York walk in New York. If they're just, they come down to their building, they come down from their penthouse and they walk to a restaurant for meeting a friend, or they walk, and they have to walk around this, they have to walk over this, they have to step over things. They're impacted by it in New York in a way that they are not in most other places. There's one benefit to the destruction of New York, is that the people who have advocated for policies that have brought about the destruction of New York are the ones experiencing it the most. They're still having that moment of denial. It's like the smoker who won't quit while they're smoking through their trach. Like, okay, you, at some point, reality is going to hit you, even if it's the last point. These people are still sort of in denial, but they're getting to the point that they're getting angry at their politicians. Now, it'd be nice if they connect those final dots, where it's like, we're mad at these politicians for what the city has become, but the politicians are doing exactly what they said they would do, and you voted for them, and you funded these people. With that in mind, there was a hearing up in New York City yesterday where I just want to play this. It's a fairly long clip, but I want to play it to demonstrate the attitude that they're dealing with, that our open border policy has emboldened in so many illegals. For dinner to somebody's house, unless you're like allergic to shellfish or something and they're serving shellfish, you don't really complain about the food. I kind of made the mistake one time. I was invited to a friend's house. His wife is French, and she made escargot, and I was like, I'm not gonna eat it. Like, just eat it. Come on, eat it. My wife is like, just eat it. I'm not going to eat a snail. I'm not interested in eating a snail. I refuse to eat the snail. I ate everything else. It wasn't like the main course was snails. Like, everybody got three snails. I just wasn't interested in it. Oh, it tastes like garlic. Well, then give me a clove of garlic. I'll eat a clove of garlic. I'm not going to eat a snail. And you don't complain about that. If you say, you call up a friend and say, hey, can I crash at your house? I'm going to be in town for 2 days. Can I crash at your house? Is that okay? You don't then write a detailed list of all the things wrong with the bed that they gave you and how you didn't care for the soap and their towels are rough and how dare you? You only had, you know, 2 eggs for bread and there was no bacon. You don't do that. You're a guest in somebody's house and you act as a guest in somebody's house. You maybe never stay there again, but you don't bitch about the way that they set you up and let you stay there. That would be rude. Well, that's not happening with the illegal alien contingent there. Up in New York, they have an influx of, they're dealing with all different groups. And of course, it being New York, everybody gets treated differently based on where they are from around the world. Everybody has to be catered to, pandered to in a different way. And so the illegals from Africa, there was a hearing where they're complaining that there are far too many languages spoken in Africa. And the illegal aliens, they don't speak English. So New York City has to provide them with people who speak not only their language, but their dialect so that they can communicate with people for their needs. They can make their demands in a language that they understand. There also, she mentions this woman that you're going to hear testifying, mentions that most of the people are illiterate in their own language, so they can't read or write. Which, again, if you're sitting there and you're playing the home game, you go, well, how are they ever going to contribute to society? The answer is they're not. You can't. If you're illiterate, you're not going to be able to contribute all that much, especially if you're illiterate in your own language and incapable of discussing things in the language of the country, those sorts of things. So with that in mind, listen to the this bit from the hearing.
There are unique dialects that are also coming that I've never heard of that I'm learning now about. People from Madagascar are coming. You have people, Burundi are coming. People from countries that are not common to us. So language access has been truly, truly a challenge, especially if you don't understand. Pulaar from Guinea and Pulaar in Mauritania, Pulaar in Senegal is very different.
So thank you, because we have to push for language access, because I have seen it, people telling me even to stay in the shelter, to wherever in the herd they cannot stay, because when they ask them to reapply, they're not getting it. And so thank you for continuing the work.
I do want to add on one thing. There is a significant amount of people who are illiterate, so written does not work. We have been sending voice clips to the migrants, explaining to them what their rights are and to understand what's going on. So it's not just written. We need vocals.
Thank you.
May I intervene for that? Because I actually taught literacy class in Brooklyn in the library of Bushwick. And we have, you know, in Africa, unfortunately for us, learning how to read and write is a privilege. And a lot of our brothers and sisters do not know how to read and write. So they only speak their, I would say, native language. Like I said, I'm from the Congo, so I was speaking only in Congolese, one of the many Congolese languages that I speak with my fellow brother and sister to help them out. So the language barrier is tremendous. We at Brooklyn, we are faced with that predicament, and we had to talk. And we actually have like six class, because we had a morning class and then we have an evening class for the ones that were literate. So without that, it's impossible for them to do anything, because they don't understand the language, they don't understand the way the city works, they don't understand anything. And you can't go nothing, you can do nothing. And like I said, I was emphasis many times that, you know, we are African, we don't speak African. We have different specificity in Africa. I'm from Central Africa. My mom is from East Africa. My mommy speaks Aramaic. My dad don't speak Aramaic. He don't even understand it. I do, because my mom is Aramaic, so I do. But only in the Congo, you have like more than 500 languages. Swahili is being spoken in Burundi, so I can speak with somebody from Burundi, but I cannot speak Swahili with somebody from Mauritania. You understand? In Europe, a Turkish don't talk for a French. A French don't talk for a Spanish. So why it is that you will put everybody in Africa in the same bag and thinking that because they speak Asanya, because they speak Pueblo, everybody will understand. You see, I told you Hakuna Matata, you couldn't understand anything. You see, so that's what we need. We need people that speak the native language to teach to those people. That's what we're asking the city, and the city refused to acclimat. And since
you can hear that. It's just a list of agreement. We can't communicate. We can't do this. We can't do that. We're not liking the food. We're not liking this. You got the illegal aliens set up in the hotels in New York, and they're given food. Part of the reason they're giving them money is because they're giving them food and they're throwing the food away. We don't like this food. Again, can you imagine? Hey, thanks for letting me stay at your house for the weekend as we're in town. Saved me a lot of money, but I couldn't help but maybe you could hit the grocery store. Get the Prime. What are you doing with this choice meat in here? What's the matter with you? Come on, can you do something about this? Can you get something with this? It is a sense of entitlement. Lord knows we have enough sense of entitlement in this country already. We don't need to invite it in. Now, I don't know if it was this way, this attitude before they were invited in, or whether or not having an entire, the world's superpower sort of bend over backwards to accommodate you instilled a sense of entitlement really quickly. But you see this all the time in these illegal aliens. This is my way. This is mine. I want this. We want that. We want the other thing. We are not bringing in. This is. There's one question that should be asked about immigration. What do we get out of it? I know it's heartless. It's mean. It's horrible. It's whatever. I don't care. It's the only question that should be asked, or the first question that should be asked. What do we get out of letting you in here into the United States of America is a privilege, not a right, even though the administration has reversed that. What do we get out of it? That's the question. And if it's nothing, then I'm sorry, you can't come in. If you have skills that we need more of, welcome. If you have seed money you want to start a company and you're going to, that's great. Welcome. This is awesome. If you come here and you're going to start complaining about the bed we're putting you in and the food we're giving you and all of that, you've got to go. Your wife or your husband, if your friend from college came in and had a total sense of entitlement and they were going to stay a month at your house, after about a week of complaining, I'm pretty sure that you would be instructed to invite them to leave. Why should it be any different? Well, because Democratic Party politics, electoral prospects do not hinge upon the douchebag you went to college with being comfortable or not in your house, whereas the Democratic Party's future is completely banked on the people you're hearing complain that we have not thoroughly vacuumed the red carpet that the Democrats are rolling out for them to invade our country. Big difference. So in the time we have left, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at the Twitter machine this morning, and I see this from, I swear to God, there are no standards at NBC News. None whatsoever. The Reed blog called The Reed Out. See, it's a play on her name. They're so clever. The race lady. She's just obsessed with race. When you got nothing, you can tell if somebody just goes back, they're a one-trick pony, that's all they bring to the table. They're terrified of being found out otherwise. And that's all that Joy Reed has over there. They have a headline on their blog by somebody called Jahan Jones. Again, with the hemlock growing naturally and free, I'm not sure how people can live with themselves. But the headline over at the readout blog on NBC News is MLB, Major League Baseball's few black players left should be a warning about the war on DEI. I'm going to read that again because it's just that stupid that you might have said that couldn't be what it actually said. It is, I swear to God. Major League Baseball's few black players left should be a warning about the war on DEI. To put a fine point, a bold and underline, the stupidity of that. The subheadline is the number of black players in Major League Baseball has plummeted to just 6%, offering a warning about what can happen when institutions de-emphasize diversity. Sports, professional sports, is one of the last bastions of merit. It truly is. You talk about merit and immigration. The last bastions of merit in general in society are in sports. If you're the best, it doesn't matter. Tom Brady, you watch that documentary about the New England Patriots. He's just, you know, a 19th round draft choice or whatever the hell he was out of the University of Michigan. And he, Drew Brees goes down. I think it was Drew Brees. Somebody goes down. And Tom Brady comes in. And all of a sudden he does really well. Normally, you sit there and you go, okay, it wasn't Drew Brees. Drew Bledsoe. There you go. It goes down. He was the franchise player, but he's hurt. Hurt bad. Tom Brady comes in and does great, does better. And so when the franchise quarterback is ready to play, the team said, it's just, well, we found someone better. But I have a contract. I have this. I have that. I have the Nike deal. I have the whatever. It doesn't matter. We found somebody better. And that's enough. That's the way professional sports works. That's the way the world should work. The left hates that. They hate merit. It's a passive acknowledgement that they can't compete in the battlefield of ideals or almost anything else. So to sit there and go, well, only 6%. Now, just for fun, I went and did some math. It was easy math. I was good at math in high school, but that doesn't mean this is good, hard math. But these are the same people, these Democrats, who talk about disproportionate impacts this, disproportionate that. There are far too many of this one in prison, not enough of that one. Far too many of this one having problems and not enough this. The weather disproportionately impacts this over that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They love proportional. They always say, you know, we need to make congressional districts majority this minority so that we can have representation, because you can only be represented by somebody who looks like you. And you should only be represented at the percentage of which you are in the population. They only make a stink out of that when the number is low. When the number is high, the NFL, you want to talk about that, the black population in the NFL relative to the population of the country. They suddenly don't want to have that conversation. So just for gits and shiggles, I went and looked at the population of the United States of America's demographics, about 13 and change percent black. Just the law of averages puts about half of that as men, right? Since we're dealing with Major League Baseball, you're dealing with black men. That's what they're complaining. There are not enough black men. If he's arguing that there aren't enough black women in Major League Baseball, he's got a point. They're currently zero. But if you're arguing black men, you say 6% is all there are. That's actually roughly in line with what black men are in the population. Theoretically, rather than bitching about this, they should be they should be saying, look at this. We've achieved the proportional representation of black men in Major League Baseball that everybody lusts for. But they can't do that. That's not what this is. This is designed to make certain demographics turn against, despise, look at it with a jaundiced eye, other demographics. The left, we've gone from a melting pot to a series of chafing dishes, and every chafing dish can be used and manipulated against another chafing dish. That's what the left does, divide to conquer. Now, there's not enough black men in Major League Baseball. Well, implicit in that, although not explicit because they can't make this case without exposing their racism, is that there are far too many Hispanics. Far too many Hispanics. Now, it's weird because in demography, depending on the need of the moment for the leftist, there is such a thing as a black Hispanic, and there is such a thing as a white Hispanic. The most famous white Hispanic in all of history is George Zimmerman, who killed Trayvon Martin before Trayvon Martin could beat holy hell out of him. He was a white Hispanic. I think he's Why would you do? I never heard that phrase before, but you have the white Hispanic. You have the black Hispanic if somebody has black skin or darker skin, and then they have a run-in with a police officer. Then they forget the Hispanic part because they get more mileage out of just the simply the black part. They play this game. They set the rules. It's spaz ball. There's no rules to spaz ball except whatever rules somebody declares at the moment, and it's null and void the second somebody else declares another rule. That's how the left operates. They can't say too many Asians. Shohei Ohtani is too bad, and oh my God, now they're looking to Japan. What they really hate about baseball is what they really hate about sports, is what they really hate about the United States of America, at least the ideal of it, and the American dream. It's about merit. The American dream is about merit. Life, your life, is what you make of it. If more people understand that, well, that's kryptonite to the Democratic Party. That'll destroy them. They'll be lost without that. They can't have that out there, so they must attack it everywhere they see it, no matter how absurd it is or contradictory to everything else they've said in the past. You're not dealing with people who let the facts stand in the way of a good story here. All right, that is enough for today. I'm going to call it a day semi-early because why not? It's Friday and I got to go swear. That's right, the Week in Effing Review, patreon.com/DerekHunterPodcast or DerekHunter.locals.com. Hopefully see you there at midnight. Be there or I'm going to do the whole show about you. How big of a jerk you are. Nah, I'm not. See you then. Thanks for listening.